The year is 58 BC, and we find ourselves at the borders of the Roman Empire during the Gallic Wars. This story isn't a product of Hollywood fiction. It's an epic story that unfolded in the annals of history. A tale of valor, cunning, and a conquest that would change the world. Welcome back, brothers and sisters. If you enjoyed our modern takes on the first book of Julius Caesar's Commentarii de Bello Gallico, you're in for a treat today. But if you're just jumping in now, no worries at all. Each chapter stands alone as its own slice of history, presented in the language we speak today. In today's episode, we dive back into the fray, bringing you a modernized retelling of the riveting battles and strategic maneuvers in the second book of Caesar's Gallic War Chronicles. Hold on to your seats as we translate the complexities of ancient warfare and political intrigue into an accessible and engaging narrative. Julius Caesar's Commentaries on the Gallic War, Book 2. When Caesar was taking a winter break in Hither Gaul, as mentioned in the Book 1, he kept getting news and letters from his right-hand man, Labienus. These messages were saying that all the Belgae, who make up a third of Gaul, were teaming up against the Romans. They were even promising each other not to back out. And here's why they were doing it. First, they were scared that once the Romans had taken over all of Celtic Gaul, they'd be next. And second, some of the Gauls were pushing them towards this. Some Gauls didn't want the Germans hanging around in Gaul any longer. But they were also not too happy about the Roman army settling in for the winter within Gaul. And some Gauls, just because they couldn't sit still and loved stirring things up, were itching for some change. Also, some people were motivated because they were used to the big shots and those with enough money to hire soldiers taking control in Gaul. And with the Romans around, that became a whole lot harder. So all these factors pushed the Belgae to conspire against the Romans. When Caesar got wind of this news, he got pretty worried, so he rounded up two more legions in southern Gaul, and as soon as summer started, he sent his deputy, Q. Pedius, to march them further into Gaul. Caesar himself hung back until there was enough food for the troops, and then he joined up with his army. He also gave orders to the Senones and other Gauls living near the Belgae to keep an eye on them and let him know what they were up to. They all came back with the same story. The Belgae were pulling together troops and building up a big army. Hearing this, Caesar figured it was time to stop sitting on his hands. He made sure he had enough supplies and then broke camp. In about 2 weeks, he and his army had made it to the Belgae's turf. So, Caesar rolled up faster than anyone expected, and this surprised the Remi, the Belgae tribe living closest to Gaul. They sent two big shots, Iccius and Antibrogius, to tell Caesar they were cool with the Romans. They hadn't joined any anti-Roman squad, and they were ready to do whatever Caesar asked. Give hostages, let him into their cities, provide food, and whatever else he needed. They also spilled the beans that the rest of the Belgae were arming up for a fight. And not just them. The Germans from across the Rhine had teamed up with the Belgae too. It was so wild that even the Suessiones, the Remi's own blood brothers, who lived under the same laws and shared the same government, couldn't resist joining the anti-Roman movement. When Caesar asked them which states were prepping for war, how strong they were, and how much they could handle in a fight, this is what he found out. Most of the Belgae were actually of German origin. They had crossed the Rhine a while back, settled in the lush lands of Gaul, and kicked out the original Gaul inhabitants. They were also the only guys who had managed to keep the Teutones and the Cimbri out of their land when these tribes were storming through Gaul, so they were pretty proud and thought they were hot stuff when it came to war. The Remi knew all the details about their numbers thanks to their close ties and alliances with the other Belgae. The biggest and baddest of the Belgae were the Bellovaci. They had a whopping 100,000 fighters and were offering 60,000 of their best men for the war. They even wanted to be the ones calling the shots in the war. Next door were the Suessiones, who had plenty of fertile land. Their king back in the day was Divitiacus, the biggest deal in all of Gaul, who even ruled part of Britain. Now their king was a dude named Galba. Because he was such a straight shooter and had a good head on his shoulders, everyone agreed he should be the one leading the war effort. They had 12 towns and were ready to bring 50,000 soldiers to the fight. Then there were the Nervi, the toughest of them all and living far off, who were also promising 50,000 fighters. The Atrebates were bringing 15,000, the Ambiani 10,000, the Morini 25,000, the Menapii 9,000, the Caleti 10,000, and both the Velocassis and the Veromandui were each bringing the same. The Aduatuci had 19,000 to offer. Lastly, the Condrusi, Eburones, Ceresi, and Pemani, all grouped under the label Germans, were believed to be able to muster up around 40,000 soldiers. Caesar, after pep-talking the Remi and treating them nicely, told their entire Senate to meet up with him and bring him their leader's kids as hostages. They did exactly as he asked, right on schedule. Then he had a serious chat with Diviakus and Aeduan about how important it was for their own safety to split up the enemy forces. He didn't want to face a massive army all at once. He suggested that this could be done if the Aedui would take their troops to the Bellovaci's lands and start messing things up. And with that, he sent Divitiacus on his way. Once Caesar noticed that all the Belgae forces were moving toward him, he got word from his scouts and the Remi that the Belgae were getting close. So he quickly led his army over the Ain River, which was right at the edge of Remi's territory, and set up camp there. This spot was perfect because the river protected one side of his camp, it put safe territory behind him, and it made it easier for the Remi and other tribes to send supplies his way. There was a bridge over the river, and he left a guard there. On the other side of the river he posted his lieutenant, Q. Titurius Sabinus, with 6 cohorts. He told Sabinus to fortify a camp with a 12-foot-high rampart and an 18-foot-wide trench. There was a Remi town called Bibrax, about 8 miles from Caesar's camp. The Belgae decided to hit this place hard on their way. The town barely held out through the day. Now the Gauls and Belgae had a similar style when it came to laying siege. They'd surround the fortifications with loads of guys, start pelting the walls with rocks from all sides, and when the defenders got thin, they'd bunch up in a tortoise formation, head to the gates, and start undermining the wall. This tactic worked pretty well this time. With so many rocks and arrows flying around, no one could stay on the wall without becoming a pincushion. When nightfall ended the attack, the guy in charge of Bibrax, Iccius, a big wig among the Remi, and one of the guys who had asked Caesar for peace, sent messengers to Caesar. He was like, "If you don't send some backup, we're toast." Straight after midnight, Caesar, guided by the same guys who brought Iccius's message, sent some sharpshooters, Numidian and Cretan archers, and Balearian slingers, to give the people in the town a helping hand. Their arrival pumped up the Remi, giving them the will and hope to resist. At the same time, it dashed the enemy's hope of capturing the town. So after hanging around the town for a bit and torching the Remi countryside, burning any villages and buildings they could reach, they moved their entire force towards Caesar's camp. They pitched camp less than 2 miles away, and from the smoke and fires it was obvious their camp was a whopper, stretching over 8 miles wide. At first, Caesar thought about avoiding a fight because the enemy not only had massive numbers, but also a badass reputation. Still, he had his cavalry poke and prod them daily to gauge the enemy's abilities and what our guys had the guts to do. When he saw that our guys weren't falling behind, he decided the area in front of the camp was a decent place to line up for a fight. The hill where the camp was had a gentle slope up from the plain, extending out enough to fit a whole army ready for battle. It had steep sides and a gentle slope down the front. On each side of this hill, he dug a cross trench about 400 paces long and built forts at the ends, placing war machines there. He didn't want the enemy, with their superior numbers, flanking his troops during the fight. After doing this, and leaving the 2 freshest legions in the camp as backup if needed, he lined up the other 6 legions battle-ready in front of the camp. The enemy did the same, getting their forces ready, having brought them out of their camp. Between our army and the enemy's was a marsh, not too big. They were waiting to see if our guys would try to cross it, while our guys were ready to pounce on them if they tried to cross first. Meanwhile, the cavalry from both sides kicked off the fighting. Since neither army seemed keen on crossing the marsh, and the skirmishes were going well for our cavalry, Caesar pulled his troops back to camp. Seeing this, the enemy bolted to the Ain River behind our camp. They found a spot shallow enough to cross and tried to get some of their forces over. The idea was that if they could, they'd storm the fort under the command of Caesar's lieutenant, Q. Titurius, and cut off the bridge. If that didn't work out, they'd wreck the lands of the Remi, which were helping us a lot in the war and keep our guys from being able to forage. Getting the news from Titurius, Caesar sends all his cavalry, light-armed Numidians, slingers and archers over the bridge and books it towards them. A fierce clash goes down at that spot. Our guys take on the disorganized enemy in the river, and a lot of them get wiped out with a crazy number of missiles. They push back the rest, who were stubbornly trying to cross over the bodies of their comrades. They then surround the first few who had crossed the river with their cavalry and hack them to bits. The enemy, seeing their plans to storm the town and cross the river fall apart and realizing our guys weren't going to engage them on less favorable ground, start running low on supplies. They hold a meeting and decide it's best for everyone to head back home. They plan to regroup wherever the Romans decide to attack first, figuring it's better to fight on home turf with their own supplies handy. This decision was also influenced by the news that Divitiacus and the Aedui were approaching the territories of the Bellovaci. They couldn't convince the latter to stick around any longer or stop them from going to help their own people. Once they made up their minds, they ditched their camp late at night, making a lot of noise and in a total mess. It wasn't organized or under control. Everyone was just looking out for themselves, trying to get home first. It pretty much looked like they were bailing. Caesar, clued in by his scouts, stayed put in camp with his army and cavalry, a little wary of a possible ambush since he wasn't yet sure why they were hightailing it. At dawn, once the scouts confirmed the news, he sent his cavalry forward to give them a hard time from the back. He handed the reins to two of his lieutenants, Cupidius and L. Aurunculeius Cotta. He told another lieutenant, T. Labienus, to follow them up closely with three legions. They chased their rear for miles, picking off a bunch of them while they ran. Those at the back who got caught put up a brave fight against our soldiers, but the guys up front, feeling safe, broke ranks and scattered at the first sound of trouble. Every one of them bolted, thinking that was their best shot at survival. So our guys had a field day, taking out as many as they could until sunset without breaking a sweat. When the day was done, they stopped the chase and headed back to camp, just as they were told. The very next day, not letting the enemy regroup from their panic and retreat, Caesar marched his army into the territory of the Suessiones, neighbors to the Remi. He covered a lot of ground and made a beeline for a town called Noviodunum. He tried to storm the place as he moved, hearing it was short on defenders, but the wide ditch and towering wall got in his way, even though there weren't many people manning them. So he set up camp, started moving his assault towers forward, and got ready for the onslaught. In the meantime, the whole group of Suessiones, still jittery from their escape, slipped into the town overnight, with the Romans quickly pushing their assault towers towards the town, throwing up a mound and erecting towers. The Gauls were gobsmacked. They'd never seen or heard of anything like this before. The Roman efficiency also rattled them, so they sent their reps to Caesar to discuss surrendering. They got their way, thanks to the Remi putting in a good word for them to be let off the hook. Caesar took the top guys of the state as hostages, including the two sons of King Galba himself. Once they handed over all their weapons, he let the Suessiones off the hook and turned his army toward the Bellovaci. They'd moved all their stuff into a town called Bratuspantium. When Caesar and his troops got within about 5 miles of the town, all the older guys came out, raising their hands to Caesar, telling him they were putting their lives in his hands and didn't plan to fight the Romans. Same deal when he arrived at the town and set up camp. The kids and women were at the wall, hands out, begging the Romans for peace in their usual way. Divitiacus put in a good word for them. After the Belgae took off, he'd sent the Aedui troops home and come back to Caesar. He said the Bellovaci had always been buddies with the Aedui. They turned against the Aedui and started trouble with the Romans because their nobles had been stirring things up, telling everyone that Caesar had the Aedui under his thumb and was treating them like dirt. Those instigators, realizing what a mess they'd caused, had hightailed it to Britain. Divitiacus explained that not just the Bellovaci, but also the Aedui were asking Caesar to go easy on them, like he usually did. If he did, he'd give the Aedui a big boost in the eyes of all the Belgae. They had always backed the Aedui up with troops and supplies whenever there was a war. Caesar told them that because he respected Divitiacus and the Aedui, he'd offer them protection and let them off easy. But since they were a big deal among the Belgae and had a hefty population, he demanded 600 hostages. Once those were handed over and all the weapons in town collected, he moved on to the territory of the Ambiani. They didn't hesitate to surrender themselves and all they had. Next up were the Nervii, and when Caesar asked around about them, he got this rundown. No traders ever went there. They wouldn't allow wine or other luxuries in, convinced that these things would make people soft and sap their courage. They were a tough, brave crowd. They looked down on the other Belgae who had given in to the Romans and tossed away their national pride. They made it clear they weren't going to send any diplomats or agree to any peace terms. After trekking through their lands for 3 days, Caesar picked up some intel from a few captives. They told him the Somber River was just a short 10-mile hop from his camp. All the Nervii were dug in on the other side, waiting for the Romans to show. They'd managed to talk the Atrebates and Veromandui, their neighbors, into joining them and giving the whole war thing a go. They were also expecting backup from the Aduatuci who were on their way. As for their women and the old folks who were no good in a fight, they'd stashed them somewhere the army couldn't reach, surrounded by marshes. Upon learning this, Caesar sent scouts and officers to find a decent spot to set up camp. Turns out a bunch of local Belgae and other Gauls had been trailing Caesar and his crew. Some of them, as Caesar later found out from prisoners, had been keenly watching how his army moved. They slipped away one night to the Nervii, telling them that the legions were separated by lots of supply wagons. They suggested an ambush, attack the first legion once it had set up camp, and the others were still miles away. With the first legion taken down and the supplies captured, the remaining legions wouldn't stand a chance. This info seemed pretty legit to the Nervii, especially since they'd been playing the underdog for a while now. They weren't big on cavalry. Even to this day, they were more of an infantry crowd. To make it tougher for their horse-riding neighbors to invade and loot, they had a crafty system. They'd cut down young trees and bend them over, letting their numerous branches spread out. Then they'd let thorny undergrowth fill the gaps, creating hedges that looked more like a fortress wall, too thick to break through or even see through. So, given that these natural barricades were going to slow down Caesar's army, the Nervii decided to take the advice of their spies. The landscape where Caesar's men decided to set up camp looked something like this. A hill sloping gently down to the Sombra River, which I mentioned earlier. On the other side of the river, a similar hill rose facing the first. At the bottom, there was a clear, open stretch about 200 paces wide. But higher up, it was thick with trees, making it tough to see what was beyond them. That's where the enemy was hiding out, with only a few horse riders showing themselves on the open land by the river. The river itself was about 3 feet deep. Once the cavalry, along with the slingers and archers, crossed the river, they started clashing with the enemy cavalry. The enemy riders would occasionally retreat into the woods for backup, then launch another attack from the cover of the trees. Our troops didn't dare chase them beyond the open plain. In the meantime, the first six legions started fortifying the camp. As soon as the enemy hidden in the woods saw the front of our baggage train, which was their cue to start their attack, they sprang into action. They formed their battle lines within the forest, psyched each other up, and then suddenly stormed out to attack our cavalry. Easily scattering our cavalry, the Nervii rushed towards the river with such speed that it felt like they were in the woods, crossing the river and closing in on us all at once. They climbed the hill to our camp at the same pace, reaching our men who were still fortifying the camp. Caesar was slammed with tasks all at once. He had to display the standard, the signal to arm up, blow the trumpet call, pull the soldiers from their tasks, call back those who'd gone to gather fortification materials, organize the troops for battle, rally the soldiers, and give the watchword. The sudden charge of the enemy and the shortage of time made most of this impossible. Under such pressure, two things came to the rescue. First, the soldiers' experience and expertise. They were seasoned enough from past battles to know what needed to be done without someone having to spell it out. Second, Caesar had earlier instructed his lieutenants not to leave their respective legions or the construction site until the camp was secure. Given the enemy's quick and unexpected arrival, the lieutenants didn't wait for Caesar's command. They acted on their own, doing what seemed best at the moment. Caesar, after giving out the necessary orders, moved quickly to wherever he was needed, rallying the troops. He arrived at the 10th Legion and gave them a quick pep talk. "Remember your usual courage, stay clear-headed, stand strong against the enemy's assault," he then signaled the start of the battle. The enemy was so close, basically in dart-throwing range. Caesar moved on to another group to motivate them, but by the time he got there, they were already in the thick of the fight. There was such little time, and the enemy was so eager for battle that there wasn't even a chance to put on military insignia or helmets, or to take the covers off shields. The soldiers had to go straight into battle from their tasks, grabbing the first standard they saw. No time to search for their own companies. Every second counted for fighting. The army was arranged more according to the lay of the land, the slope of the hill, and the urgency of the moment, rather than following any traditional military strategy. The legions were scattered, holding off the enemy in different areas, and the thick hedges, as mentioned before, blocked the view. As a result, they couldn't properly place backup troops, coordinate efforts across all fronts, or have one person give all the commands. In such a chaotic situation, different strokes of luck unfolded. The soldiers of the 9th and 10th legions positioned on the left side of the army quickly chased the Atrebates, their opposing force, off the high ground and into the river. These enemies, already out of breath from running and fatigued from their wounds, were slaughtered in large numbers while trying to cross. Our men didn't hesitate to cross the river either. Despite being on uneven terrain, they managed to send the enemy, who had rallied and returned, running once again. In another part of the battlefield, the 11th and 8th legions, having routed the Veromandui, were fighting from higher ground near the riverbank. However, with the majority of the camp exposed on the front and left, and the 12th Legion situated on the right wing, and the 7th not far from it, all the Nervii, led by Boduognatus, their chief, charged towards that spot. They were so closely packed together that some began to flank the legions, catching them off guard, while others made a dash for the highest point of the camp. Meanwhile, our cavalry and light-armed infantry, who had previously been beaten back by the enemy's initial assault, were heading back to the camp when they ran into the enemy again. Panic set in, and they fled in different directions. Also, the camp followers who had ventured out for loot and had seen our men cross the river victoriously now turned to see the enemy strutting around in our camp. They hastily took off in terror. On top of all this, the loud cries and shouts of those with the baggage train added to the chaos. They were running helter-skelter, some this way, some that way. This scene greatly alarmed the cavalry of the Treviri, a tribe known for their exceptional bravery among the Gauls and who had come to assist Caesar. Seeing our camp teeming with enemy soldiers, our legions heavily pressed and nearly surrounded, and our camp retainers, cavalry, slingers, and Numidians scattering in all directions, they lost hope. Believing that all was lost, they hurried back home, reporting to their people that the Romans had been defeated and the enemy had taken over our camp and seized our supplies. After bolstering the morale of the 10th Legion, Caesar headed towards the right flank. He saw his troops in dire straits. The 12th Legion standards were all clustered in one place, causing the soldiers to get in each other's way. The 4th cohort had lost all its centurions, their standard-bearer was dead, and the standard itself was missing. Nearly all the centurions from the other cohorts were wounded or dead. Among them was the Legion's top centurion, P. Sextius Baculus, a brave soldier who was so severely injured that he could barely stand. Caesar also noticed that the rest of the soldiers were losing their spirit. Some, feeling abandoned by those behind them, were backing away from the fight and trying to dodge the enemy's weapons. Meanwhile, the enemy, despite attacking uphill, kept pushing relentlessly at the front and pressing hard on both flanks. It was clear that the situation had reached a critical point and there were no reserves to call upon. So Caesar, having grabbed a shield from a soldier in the back ranks, since he had arrived without one, stepped to the front. He called out to the centurions by name, encouraged the soldiers, and ordered them to advance the standards and spread out their ranks for better use of their swords. His arrival injected hope into the soldiers and renewed their courage. Everyone, under their general's watchful eye, was keen to give it their all. This managed to slightly stem the enemy's fierce onslaught. Noticing that the 7th Legion nearby was also under intense pressure from the enemy, Caesar instructed the military tribunes to gradually merge the legions. They were to create a double-fronted assault on the enemy. Once this strategy was executed, the legions started supporting each other. No longer fearful of being surrounded from the rear, they held their positions more confidently and fought back with increased courage. In the meantime, soldiers from the 2 legions assigned as guards for the baggage train hurried up the hill as soon as they heard about the battle. Their arrival on the crest of the hill was visible to the enemy below. Concurrently, Titus Labienus, who had taken over the enemy's camp and had a vantage point over our own camp, sent the 10th Legion as backup. As these reinforcements raced towards the conflict, they realized from the fleeing horsemen and sutlers how dire the situation was. They understood the serious danger facing the camp, the legion, and their commander, and they didn't waste a moment getting to the battlefield. The arrival of the reinforcements brought about a significant shift in the battlefield dynamics. Even our men, the ones who'd been brought to their knees by wounds, propped themselves up on their shields and rejoined the fight. Seeing the enemy in such a disarray, even the unarmed camp followers attacked the armed foes, eager to erase the disgrace of their earlier retreat. Our cavalrymen thrust themselves into the front line of the battle, everywhere they could. But even faced with the most desperate of circumstances, the enemy showed remarkable bravery. When their front ranks fell, the ones behind climbed onto the fallen bodies to continue the fight. As more and more fell, creating a mound of the dead, the survivors continued to fight from atop this gruesome hill. They even threw back at us our own weapons that had fallen short. This situation proves that these highly courageous men hadn't rashly decided to cross a wide river, scale steep banks, or assault a highly unfavorable position. Their fearless spirit made these seemingly insurmountable tasks doable. Once the battle was over and the Nervii nation was nearly wiped out, their elders, who, along with the children and women, heard of the battle's outcome. Realizing that there was nothing that could stop the conquerors and no safety for the defeated, they decided to surrender. They sent ambassadors to Caesar, and when explaining their devastating situation, they said their council of elders had been decimated from 600 to just 3, and from their 60,000 men, barely 500 could still bear arms. In response, Caesar showed great mercy towards these desperate and pleading people. He ordered them to return to their own lands and towns and commanded their neighbors to refrain from any harm or offensive actions against them. He wanted to make it clear that he had compassion for those who had been defeated and sought his mercy. The Aduatuci, who I mentioned earlier, were initially on their way to help the Nervii. However, when they heard about the battle's outcome, they quickly changed their minds and headed back home. They abandoned all their towns and forts, gathering everything they owned into one naturally well-fortified town. This town was surrounded by steep cliffs and precipices on all sides, except for one gently sloping approach about 200 feet wide. They had secured this place with a towering double wall, and on top of it they had positioned heavy stones and sharp stakes. They traced their roots back to the Cimbri and Teutones tribes. When these tribes were migrating towards our province and Italy, they left behind their excess baggage on this side of the Rhine River. They assigned 6,000 of their people to guard these possessions. After their countrymen were defeated, these guardians spent many years skirmishing with their neighbors, sometimes attacking and sometimes defending. Eventually, they agreed to a peace deal with everyone's consent and decided to settle in this spot. At first, when our army arrived, they frequently darted out from the town, engaging our soldiers in minor skirmishes. However, as we built a 12-foot-high rampart around them, stretching 15 miles in total, they pulled back and hunkered down within their town walls. Once we started rolling up our siege towers and building a mound to reach their walls, they began mocking us from atop their fortifications. "What's the point of such a huge contraption built so far away?" they jeered. They questioned our strength and capability. "With what kind of muscle, especially considering you're such tiny guys, do you expect to push that massive tower against our walls?" They generally looked down on us due to our shorter stature, considering their own towering height a point of pride, and used it as a topic for ridicule. But when they saw our towering siege engine creeping closer to their walls, the unfamiliar sight spooked them. In response, they sent envoys to Caesar to negotiate peace. They told him, "We didn't think the Romans could wage war without divine help, considering how you're able to rapidly move such gigantic machines and fight from so close. We surrender ourselves and all our possessions to your mercy. We have one request, though. If your renowned clemency and kindness decide to spare us, the Aduatuci, please don't strip us of our weapons. All our neighbors are our enemies, jealous of our bravery, and we wouldn't be able to defend ourselves against them without our arms. If we're brought to such a state, we'd rather face whatever the Romans have in store for us than be tormented to death by those we used to rule over." In response, Caesar said, "In line with my usual practice, not because you deserve it, I'll spare your state as long as you surrender before my battering ram touches your walls. But let's be clear, you can only surrender if you give up your weapons. I'll treat you the way I did with the Nervii, and I'll tell your neighbors not to mess with those who have surrendered to the Romans." When they reported this to their people, they agreed to follow Caesar's orders. They chucked a massive pile of their weapons from the wall into the trench before the town until the heaps of arms nearly reached the top of the wall and rampart. Still, they kept and hid about a third of their weapons in the town, as we found out later. They opened the gates and enjoyed a day of peace. As evening fell, Caesar gave the order to close the town gates and told his soldiers to leave so the townspeople wouldn't get hurt during the night. The Aduatuci, who had hatched a plan as we later found out, thought that because they'd surrendered, our guys would let down their guard, or at least not keep such a close eye on things. Using the weapons they'd hidden and some makeshift shields they'd cobbled together out of bark and woven wicker, covered in skins, due to the time crunch, they suddenly burst out of the town in the third watch. They chose the direction where they thought it'd be easiest to climb our fortifications. Immediately the signal fires were lit, as Caesar had instructed before, and our nearest soldiers rushed to the spot. The enemy fought as fiercely as you'd expect from brave men, whose only hope was to fight in a tough spot against those raining down weapons from a rampart and towers with all hope resting on their courage alone. Around 4,000 of them were killed, and the rest were pushed back into the town. The next day, Caesar busted open the gates, now undefended, and sent our soldiers in. All the spoils of the town were sold off. He was told by those who did the buying that there were 53,000 people. Around the same time, Caesar got word from P. Crassus, who he had dispatched with a single legion to handle the Veneti, the Unelli, the Osismi, the Curiosolitae, the Sesuvi, the Aulerci, and the Redones, all coastal tribes bordering the Atlantic Ocean. The news was good. All these nations were now under the control of the Roman people. With all these victories under their belt and Gaul completely subdued, word of the Romans' military prowess had spread far and wide. Even the tribes living beyond the Rhine were sending ambassadors to Caesar, offering hostages and vowing to follow his commands. Busy preparing for his expeditions to Italy and Illyricum, Caesar told them to check back with him at the start of the next summer. He stationed his legions to winter in the lands of the Carnutes, the Andes, and the Turones, all near the regions where he'd been battling. After setting his troops up, Caesar headed for Italy. His successes were so significant that, after receiving his report, the Senate declared a 15-day celebration. This honor had never been bestowed on anyone before. And there we have it, folks, from the ferocious resilience of the Nervi to the cunning sally of the Aduatuci to the final surrender of the Maritime States, we've journeyed through the gripping second book of Julius Caesar's Gallic War Chronicles. I hope you've enjoyed this modernized trip into the past as much as I've enjoyed bringing it to you. Remember, history is a never-ending story, and there are countless tales yet to be told. We'll be continuing our exploration of Caesar's exploits and many other documents from European history. If you want to make sure you don't miss out on our next historical adventure, you know what to do. Until then, keep exploring, stay curious, and remember, history isn't just about the past, it's about understanding our present through the lens of those who came before us. This is your journey into history, signing off for now.